Coming up next in This Week in Computer Hardware, more RAM or faster RAM? Is the OCC Vertex 4 512GB SSD a must-have or a must-avoid? Make a 32-inch HD TV work as a desktop monitor. The iPad 3 review and AMD's latest bulldozer didn't knock us over. And the Momentus XT versus SSD and more, all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 164, recorded April 5th, 2012. Vertex 4 and toilet PCs.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. And by Ford, featuring voice-activated Sync App Link. Now you can control select smartphone apps with your voice, helping keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. Learn more about the technologies Ford is bringing to its vehicles at ford.com/technology.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, the show where each and every week we track down the big news in computer hardware, talk a little bit about tablets, phones, and of course, answer your questions. Who's we? Ryan Shrout and myself, Patrick Norton. Ryan, how's it going this week? You are obviously still on cloud 11.
Yes. Past nine, I spent the weekend in New Orleans with my dad and my wife. We went to the Final Four. Obviously, very big Kentucky Wildcat fans, and the sign behind me here. We'll let you know that they won in case you guys didn't watch. So that's just a temporary addition to the set. But yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Like until they win the next championship, and then you replace
right, until,
the next
until
championship
until we replace
banner.
The eight up there with a nine. Yeah, exactly. So that's good.
Ladies and gentlemen, be true to your school, just like Ryan Shrout. It's not quite as big news. My second child was born at 7:08 a.m. on Sunday morning.
Wow.
And he decided to figure out how to wake himself up in the whole process of eating every 2 hours last night. So if I look like today's show is brought to you by caffeine, it was.
Nice.
It's been exciting. So we should probably start out. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's one of those moments where you're like, wow. I forgot how loud a little 8-pound creature can be.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Baby's in good health. Mama's in good health. We're really excited. And I'm basically podcasting from a corner farthest from the small creature should he wake up and be very angry about being hungry. So,
understandable.
Interesting stuff. Top of the story list this week is the PCPro.com full review of the iPad 3, or what you're basically saying. We're calling it the iPad 3 because calling it the new iPad and differentiating that from the previous two new iPads is too big of a pain in the posterior. And yeah. It's kind of funny because it's been an interesting couple of weeks for the iPad, right? So people are like, oh my goodness, the batteries aren't charging correctly. And it's like, well, actually, batteries are charged based to, you know, on computer module, basically computer modeled simulations or basically battery charging is programmed, relax people, the battery's performing the way it's supposed to. The next thing comes up, it's hot. It's burning my legs. It's the hottest tablet ever. Actually, a bunch of people went around and tested Android tablets and found that they're just as hot and that, you know, the iPad 2 isn't especially hot. It's hotter than some people want, but it will always be. The camera performance is crippled like pretty much every other camera in a tablet or a phone in that it could use a bigger, better sensor. No big shock there, although with bright light, it does a pretty good job.
Yeah.
And I thought it was funny, Matt Smith did the review for PC Per, and he had the reaction I had when I first saw the legendary Retina display. And when you first look at it, if you're not looking at something that where you've kind of been prepped to see the glory with the right content at the right time, you look at it and go, huh, this looks an awful lot like an iPad.
Yep.
And Matt made a really good point where he goes, you don't really realize it until you're looking at, say, a text page and you don't have to expand to read it because It is so detailed and so clear that you can actually read like the 4-point text on the page without difficulty. And that's a big deal. As we'll be talking, one of the viewer questions later in the show is talking about jaggies on larger monitors. And the reason you have jaggies on larger monitors is because there's not, the pixels aren't packed tightly enough together to eliminate the jaggies, the stair stepping instead of, you know, nice angled lines or curves. And what's really interesting about that, and something Matt does a really good job discussing, is that because they increased the screen resolution so drastically, they had to make huge improvements on the GPU side of the thing on the integrated processor. And that's probably where I should hand it off to you.
Well, in truth, we don't really know a whole lot of detail about the graphics in there. They're calling it quad-core graphics, which they basically... You know, some people would complain because they doubled graphics performance compared to the iPad 2, but they quadrupled the resolution. So what is it really enough performance? You know, you look at some of the games that they've put out there, some of the basically tech demonstrations like Infinity Blade 2,
right.
Which I did download and was impressive looking, but I didn't find the game very engaging.
Right.
They're cool to look at. But much like you, I had the same responses as you and Matt did about just the screen. Like, I turned on, I was like, well, I know I'm supposed to be really impressed with this, so let me get really close and look. And, you know, I had several questions, you know, since I've had it. It's like, oh, is that the new one? What do you think about it? How, you know, should I get the new one? As if you have an iPad 2, I really don't see a need to upgrade to this one. And right. I did a lot of... you know, show them to both people and just say, here are the two screens, right? And people who weren't tech enthusiasts and didn't know what to look for didn't right. notice the difference right off the bat. And I think most people expected that to be different. They expected this to be just earth changing, like going from standard definition TV to HD TV on your right. on your 50-inch screen. And it just wasn't the case. I've still been really impressed with it. I used it all through being on trips for the last 10 days and came away, you know, pretty impressed with the performance, the capabilities, and the AT&T 4G LTE speeds are really good. If you have it available in a city that can actually run it. And even that, the HSDPA Plus is still pretty speedy. I guess Matt's conclusion, it's still the best tablet. It's not a giant leap forward over the iPad 2, like maybe some people had indeed expected. It's still the best tablet out there. I think that kind of goes without saying.
Yeah,
it's pretty good.
Well, you know, I think a lot of our Android fans in the audience would probably disagree that it's the best tablet, but it is certainly the strongest tablet out there in terms of a single product or single product line picking up such a huge chunk of sales. I had got to have a conversation with someone I got to know through one of their applications, and which is a 3D rendering application, or basically it's a mapping application that renders 3D data in real time. And it was thrilling for him to be able to have this incredibly dense, high resolution display to work with. But it was also really frustrating because, you know, you pick up the graphic speed, you make a much larger increase in the pixel density, and you end up with performance that looks similar to the previous previous hardware, the iPad 2. And so he said it for him as a programmer, he had to really step it up and find additional places to pick up performance to make the application feel as snappy as he wanted it to feel on the new iPad. But it'll be interesting. I agree, definitely an evolutionary, a small evolutionary step, not a radical step. I think it'll be interesting to see what kind of applications really mature to take advantage of the resolution of the display, or if it's just reading nerds that are going to get really excited about the text on ebooks.
Yeah.
You know, recently we had the Samsung's 830, and now challenging at the OCZ Vertex 4, the 512 gigabyte SSD. Quote, Vertex returns to its Indie Links roots. Alan, of course, wrote this one up for PCPer.com. And it was interesting. This is something I've read some reviews here and there, and people are super excited about this. But it really needs some work on the firmware to live up to the potential of the hardware inside of this, I think is the short summary on this one.
Yeah, it's I don't think Alan, I think, was one of the only one, if not the only one, to do a review testing different firmwares from OCZ. It shipped with like 1.3, and I think he ended up testing 1.51 and 1.52 when he noticed some problems. You know, I think a lot of people are excited about this hardware because it has the Vertex name. The very first Vertex was an IndieLynx drive. Then Vertex 2 and 3 were SandForce-based drives. And now that OCZ owns IndieLynx, they bought that controller company. And we saw the Octane model of SSDs come out using the IndieLynx Everest controller. This new version, the IndieLynx Everest 2, which actually, Alan says they didn't give us a whole lot of information on what's new about it. It's still a dual-core controller, slightly higher clock rate at 400 megahertz, 8 channels, and 1 gig of DDR3 800 onboard DRAM for that. But it the hardware is better. But there are some people that had some performance issues, reviewers, I mean, that had performance issues with the drive and the way it initially tested. And Alan saw that and was able to communicate back and forth with OCZ enough to get updated firmwares that they were still working on that addressed a lot of the issues. So, yeah, you're right. Your kind of general consensus here is that the hardware seems pretty good. It seems like once the software catches up that it will be a very fast drive. But I find it hard to recommend an SSD, you know, if you want to go out and buy it today or tomorrow or next week, that may not have a fully baked firmware. Because we talked about this on our show last night. To me, the idea of upgrading the firmware on your primary storage drive, even if you do your backups and all that kind of stuff like you're really supposed to do, still scares me. I don't like the idea of updating the firmware on my hard drive, even if it's only got Windows and games installed on it and applications. Because even if you don't lose a lot of data, you're going to lose a lot of time if something should happen and you need to reformat and start over if a firmware doesn't just kind of upgrade the way you would expect it to.
Yeah, so this definitely sounds like something where, you know, buy an 830 or wait to see where the firmware settles out. And if you do buy one of the new Vertex drives from OCZ, do yourself a favor and upgrade the firmware as quickly as possible. There's been a small bulldozer refresh. The simple fact that you titled it a small bulldozer refresh means it's not going to be earth-shaking news for the processor. Basically, more megahertz for the processors. Did I mention the baby was up every 2 hours last night? More megahertz for the masses. It's pretty much just an incremental upgrade, right?
Well, yeah. So this is, you know, when the bulldozer first came out, we tested the FX8150, which was the top end bulldozer part, the 8-core/4 module part. This is actually a quad core 2 module part. So this is kind of like the lower cost version of bulldozer. And, you know, a little bit of background on it is we've been trying to get a hold of one of these processors for quite a while to do performance testing against similarly priced Intel parts and previous generation AMD parts, and they were very hesitant, I guess I'll say, to send us those. I'm sorry, this is actually a 3-module 6-core part, not a 2-module 4-core part. But it's a little bit lower performing as you'd expect, but it's still 125-watt TDP processor, which is pretty high, especially if you consider the rumors about the upcoming Ivy Bridge parts that are going to have like 70 or 80 watt TDPs.
Wow. That's really low.
Yeah. And the problem is what nothing has really changed, unfortunately, for AMD when we look at these lower priced parts. It still is falling behind their own Phenom X6 processors of the previous generation in most cases. In the cases where it is, it does have a slight advantage. It is a very slight advantage. And there are some cases where even the X4980 quad-core part is able to outperform this 6-core processor, the FX6200. And, the reason, if you look at the overclocking and power consumption page, I think it's the most telling thing about it. Because at stock settings, stock clocks, under a load, the FX6200 bulldozer part uses about, 10 to 15 watts more power than the X6 1100T, which is fine, right? It's not that much. And in some cases, it performs better, but in most cases, it's on par or a little bit less. And it uses about maybe 15 to 20 watts more than the Phenom 2 X4 processor, but it doesn't really offer that much more performance. But look at the bottom graph there. The FX6200 at 4.5 gigahertz, so that's pretty highly overclocked, is using 315 watts. Now, that's entire system, so that's not the processor itself. But right. Keep in mind that we're talking about almost 90 watts performance difference or power consumption difference from the base FX6200 to the overclocked FX6200. I mean, this thing has huge leakage issues, right? It's just the process and the design are not meant to go any faster than the parts that the FX8150 and this FX6200 are running at. Because even that modest increase of, you know, say, I don't know, was it 600 megahertz overclock, something like that, right. Just basically doubles the power consumption of the processor, which is not great. It's not good news. It's not good news for AMD. And any thoughts that we once had that AMD was somehow going to be able to tweak a couple of things in the process technology with GlobalFoundries, or tweak a couple of things in the processor and decrease power consumption, increase clock speed, pretty much have gone out the window until they maybe come out with something just totally different. You know, we'll see Pile Driver Core coming up in Trinity processors for desktops and mobile machines probably before the summer. Mm-hmm. And we'll I'm very eager to see if this helps anything, but it doesn't leave me with a pleasant feeling for AMD's processor division, especially when you look at, like I said, Ivy Bridge coming out with like 77 or 80 watt TDPs hitting the same 3.7 gigahertz clock speed and having better overall IPC and stuff. So
if this were Intel several years ago, this would be the time to pick up a Israeli firm that had made some spectacular advances in CPU technology.
The analogies to Prescott are staggering, really.
Yeah, it's kind of odd. We should take a moment to thank one of our sponsors, Netflix. They're one of our favorite services out there. They stream video directly to your face. And I actually... forgot to cut the notes in there. Pardon me.
No, everybody. I did that. I've got them at the bottom there. Not a problem. But it doesn't really matter. We don't really need. We've been doing this ad for long enough.
The
I don't
service
really need notes,
that but needs no introduction.
That's right. If you're listening to the show and you haven't heard of Netflix, you've definitely heard of Netflix, but you maybe have never heard us talk about it. And we are talking to you specifically. We want you to try Netflix out. You get to try it for 30 days, absolutely free through this offer. And Netflix is the streaming service for TV and movies that I think are infinitely useful. It is an infinitely useful service. If you travel a lot, if you commute back and forth to work, you can watch streaming shows and movies instantly on your TV, on your phone, on your iPad, on lots of other devices. If you want to watch on your TV, you can use an Xbox 360. You can use a PlayStation 3, a Nintendo Wii, a Roku box, an Apple TV. You know, your DVD player or Blu-ray player may already have Netflix streaming support built in. There's tons of options for that. iPhone is supported. The iPad is supported. Many Android phones are now supported. And it's you could basically get Netflix streaming anywhere. One of the best features that I think takes advantage of that kind of ubiquitous availability is you can start watching a show on your downstairs TV, on your Blu-ray player. You're tired, you want to go up to bed. You can finish it through, if you got your TV up there has it, or your Blu-ray player, your DVD player has Netflix support, you can just immediately start watching where you left off. Or even the next morning, you can watch it on your phone on the bus ride in to work or something like that. It's really a cool feature that kind of epitomizes the benefits of IP-based video and how much better it is than standard traditional video distribution methods. So we definitely want you to try this out. You can get 30 days completely free. All you have to do is go to netflix.com/twit. Now you can watch as many shows as you want, as many times as you want. There's no limit in this 30-day trial, or even once you actually sign up for the service and continue to enjoy it. 30 days completely free, netflix.com/twit. That's the URL you need to go to so you can help us help you guys, supporting us, supporting Netflix. That's what it's all about. But we definitely think you're going to like the service, so give it a try. Netflix.com/twit. We thank Netflix for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware and the entire Twit network. So there you go.
There you have it.
We got some more news for this week?
Well, so it's kind of funny. ZDNet and several other sites published articles discussing the rising prices of PCs. And Scott over at PC Per suggests that these articles need a grain of salt. One of the things I think Scott takes the whole post-PC concept particularly personally. It's like PC's dead, PC's over, PC's not going anywhere. And one of the analysts at Barclays Capital basically wrote that PC components are getting more expensive due to a series of recent events. And it's kind of funny. So, so ZDNet, Barclays, they are discussing, they're discussing PC news for investors, people who invest in stock, right? But they're talking about, like, you know, the one that they really skewers them on. ZDNet claims that Apple will have an advantage due to their switch to solid-state devices in MacBook Airs and iPads. And the truth is Apple doesn't have an advantage. They just have a product line that pretty much starts at $1,000 and move up. PC manufacturers in that price range can use and often do use SSDs, so there's no real advantage at that point. LCD panels are expected to elevate in the near future as OEMs build up inventory ahead of the launch of Windows 8-based products. It's got points out, hey, prices of components tend to rise when you abruptly spike in sales. This is not new. DRAM prices have gone up 7% compared to just a few months ago. RAM is so ridiculously cheap. You know, I think it was maybe due for an increase. I mean, you know, RAM like dropped off. The RAM price has dropped off the side of a cliff, and it's been a while since we've seen anything that remotely resembles a registerable RAM increase. And 7%, not all that much. So, if you've been panicking and thinking I should start squirreling away PC components now, stop. It's a non-issue.
Don't do that.
What is a an issue, though, is using toilet water to cool your PC.
You know, I put this story in specifically for you, Patrick, because I wanted to judge whether or not you thought this was disturbing or incredibly ingenious.
Yes.
Okay, fair. We can do both.
So if you take it's kind of interesting, right? You take a look at that picture. Chad's got a beautiful shot of that on the screen for everybody watching the video right now. And you basically see two pieces of tubing looping into the toilet bowl, which is a wonderful source of
Not the toilet bowl.
Excuse me, the toilet tank.
Yes, that would be a totally different issue. Let's not confuse those.
You are absolutely correct, but it's kind of funny. Somebody was like, oh, Google's using toilet water to help cool their data center. Well, somebody pointed out that several years ago, Jeff Gagnon did a toilet-cooled PC. It's actually a pretty epic case model. If you click on the Extreme Tech link inside of there, right, because you see that little hole above the toilet tank. Well, on the other side of that hole above the toilet tank in the wall is the water-cooled PC. Basically mounted, the parts mounted to a wall, something one of my favorite PC mods is just hanging it on a wall, in this case with a gigantic portrait of Tux embracing the PC parts on there. So I got to say, it's a good way to keep a steady source of cool water available for your PC. There's a reason hungover people hug toilet bowls. It's because they're cool, because all that water evaporating.
You looked at that wall, like even the power supply was fully exposed. It had the case removed. I wouldn't recommend that to anybody, really. No. Those capacitors are pretty large. It doesn't look like an incredibly new system either, based on, I guess I can't really tell if that's a PCI Express, PCI slot or anything like that. But it was interesting. We had to toss that in here. We really, really needed to just show everybody. I kind of thought, who was it that I knew? Somebody at Intel that actually put a pump in their pool. They had a big, like, industrial-level pump that they just, like, would throw in the pool, and they just ran tubing from, you know, and you know, had to downsize it several times, and they had this extreme amount of flow through their water cooling setup in their computer. Now, I would call that much more extreme than the toilet cooler, but maybe not as kind of instantaneously disgusting as the idea of a toilet-cooled computer, you know. Whatever works. So, everybody's got their own thing.
I'm kind of laughing. I'm wondering at what point he was like, you know, just on the other side of this toilet is a wall I could mount a PC on. By the way, if you've something I forgot to mention earlier when we talked about the iPad 3, if you are having issues with Wi-Fi, and a lot of people are, Apple Care is going to replace any units that are displaying Wi-Fi weirdness. 9to5Mac.com's got a pretty good write-up on it. Basically, intermittent connectivity, slow Wi-Fi speeds, you can't find your Wi-Fi network. Something is going on with the Wi-Fi on the iPad 3, and because people are basically saying, like, yeah, I've got it next to my, you know, my wife's iPad. Her iPad is fine. My new iPad isn't working well. And interesting, the sort of last paragraph in the 9to5Mac article, quote, iPads that are affected by Wi-Fi issues are supposed to be, quote, captured, unquote. According to one source, captured is code for the device to be immediately packed up and shipped to Apple's engineering centers for examination and investigation. So,
I'm going to remember that terminology and use it.
Capture that.
Yeah.
Speaking of something you might want to capture, this episode of Twitch is brought to you by Ford, featuring available voice-activated sync app link. If you've never used it, it's actually really amazing. It lets you control certain select mobile apps from your smartphone using simple voice commands. It lets you keep your hands on the wheel, your eyes on the road. Sync app link, you can control a voice control app from Pandora, Stitcher, OpenBeak, Slacker Radio, iHeartRadio, and NPR in your car. And you can actually take advantage of some pretty cool applications. Sync Destinations gets access to navigation and directions through your compatible smartphone. NPR, you get the latest breaking news and play your favorite NPR programs. iHeartRadio's ThumbPlay service. Simple voice commands. You can find your save station, skip to the next song, even give a song a thumbs up. And it's really got a lot of potential because Sync AppLink is built on an API platform. So Ford and app developers can bring in-vehicle voice control to more apps without you having to update the AppLink software in the vehicle. Basically, the application on your phone is modified to run with the AppLink in the dashboard so they can bring more features, more technology to you without having to upgrade the firmware in your car. This is a good thing. Ford's got a Sync mobile application developer network that enables developers to contact Ford about their app ideas, allowing Ford to bring them to you faster. And you can expect to see more Sync-enabled mobile apps that can go along for the ride in Ford vehicles. And do us a favor, on behalf of our sponsor, or because we are really excited when Ford sponsors us, to check out Sync, AppLink, and other technologies at ford.com/technology.
All right. Now, we're going to get into a couple of emails here, a handful of emails for this episode. And we want to remind you, we need you to send us your emails, twitch@twit.tv, twitch@twit.tv, with your questions, comments. If you've got any thoughts about previous episodes and maybe comments we made, if you have better suggestions, we're always open for those types of ideas. So definitely keep sending them in. Let's take our first. You had a tweet here listed. Was there something you wanted to address here? Was there a...
We'll save that for next week.
Okay.
Because that one that one's an interesting conversation. I'd actually like to bring Robert Heron in on that one, talking about the 23.397 frame per second issue. We got an email from Steven, who's a longtime listener, going all the way back to the Tech TV days. He has a question about true SSDs versus a Seagate Momentus XT hybrid drive. He says, my boss loves his hybrid drive. However, I'm not sure what the negatives of this drive versus a true SSD would be. Cannot seem to find many reviews comparing an XT or Momentus XT to an SSD. I would love the extra space I could have with an XT, but I'm not sure what I'm sacrificing. My price range is under $200. Thanks again for the fantastic show. Short answer is you spend less, you get more capacity, and you get a lot of the performance of a solid state drive. Now, what you are sacrificing is having solid state speed for every single bit stored on your hard drive. What the Momentus XT does is essentially has a huge chunk of cache on it, caches the most important data directly to that cache so that when your CPU makes a request for data, it's going to the cache on the hard drive rather than the rotating platter, the regular spinning platter on the hard drive. I don't know anybody who's got a Momentus XT that doesn't love it. And if you want something that is faster than a traditional rotating hard drive, but a heck of a lot less expensive per megabyte than a SSD, the Momentus XT is really pretty much it.
Yeah, and you can get into other options like the Intel SRT technology, which allows you to use a small SSD, like a standard 2.5-inch SSD, or even one of the MSATA SSDs, with the traditional hard drive, and you get some of the basically the same idea. As you're using that SSD simply as a cache for a traditional hard drive, but you bring your own hard drive, you bring your own SSD. And we've had a lot of good success with that technology as well. Now, I know, Patrick, you included in the show notes there an article that Alan wrote on hybrid storage, the Seagate Momentus versus the Revo drive versus the Intel Z68, which implements that SRT technology. And it's actually, it's a really good write-up, and it gives you pretty detailed explanation of what the pros and cons of each are. So if you're, Steven, if you're interested in that kind of stuff, definitely check that article out. Alan is pointing out to me in the chat that the Momentus only has 8 gigs of SLC memory on it, which is barely enough to hold an operating system, but it's good enough for typical desktop type applications. Right. So, yeah,
it would be. I always wonder why they didn't put more on there, but you start to realize when you start putting more on there, you start incurring the cost of traditional SSD or a traditional. You know, SSDs are so normal now; we can call them traditional SSDs.
They've moved on in the world.
So definitely check out Alan's article up at PCPer.com. Hybrid storage roundup, Seagate Momentus XT versus OCZ Revo drive, hybrid versus Intel Z68. We got an email from Jason. He says, is it better to have more RAM at lower speeds or less RAM at higher speeds? As you know, RAM comes in different speeds, but I was wondering about this.
It's a really simple question. I like it. It's very succinct and quick, but it has very complicated answers most of the time. Is it better to have more RAM at lower speeds or less RAM at higher speeds? It always depends on how much more RAM and how much slower speeds and, you know, how much less RAM and how much higher speeds.
And what operating system, and is it 32 or 64-bit?
Yes. Well, let's go under the assumption now that everybody has a 64-bit OS. Because other than that, going over 4 gigs becomes kind of useless. I would say it depends somewhat on your use cases, but my general rule is I would rather have more memory than faster memory. I would rather have 32 gigs of DDR3 1333 than 16 gigs of DDR3 1866. Now, there are some applications that are maybe rendering specific, that are rendering smaller subsets of data quickly. It could use faster memory more than they could use more memory. But if you start looking at the majority of applications for 3D rendering, video rendering, audio rendering, the more memory you have, the better. And the performance difference between, say, DDR3 1333 and 1600 megahertz and 1866 megahertz and 2100 megahertz starts to diminish, right? You're going to see fairly low return on investment there. And when you start looking at how much more expensive this memory gets, it will make probably less sense. We're almost to the point now where 1600 megahertz is the minimum, right? Like that's just kind of like the cheapest memory you can buy, or it's within a dollar or two of 1333, in which case go for that. But if you start seeing 20%, 30%, 50% price increases for higher speed memory, I would lean towards the memory capacity. That's going to be, I think, more important in the long run than speed, unless you're doing you want benchmark scores and overclocking. Then you go for the highest speed possible. But if you're like, I actually want to use my computer, then you should just get more capacity.
I completely agree. I think more than several years ago, memory speed used to be a big deal. Memory speed used to be something you could actually see in real world or more mostly in benchmarks. And these days, people obsess about memory speed because it sounds so much bigger. It's not 1300, it's 1600. And the reality is you're not going to feel it in your PC unless you're a very small subset of usage cases. Matt's got a question about Jaggies on big screens. It says, I recently built my first custom PC. Congratulations, Matt. I have an AMD FX8150 CPU, Gigabyte HD6970, overclocked to 900 megahertz, 16 gigs of DDR3 1600 megahertz RAM, as well as a 120 gigabyte Corsair SSD. I get great boot times and have no problem with speed or temperatures, but despite my great GPU, I have poor visuals in games. Even with 8x anti-aliasing in games and running them at 1080p, the picture is still grainy with jagged edges. I think it may be due to my monitor. I'm using a 32-inch Panasonic TV, but I can't afford to buy a new 1600 by 2560 monitor because I blew 99% of my budget on my PC. So I always say balance things. Do you know any ways to make the picture quality better? I've already tried putting all the settings on max and tweaking the TV settings as well for optimum sharpness, etc. Matt, there is a very simple answer to your problem. You need to move, when you're gaming, you need to move that HDTV farther away from where you are sitting. That is the one way you are going to make a 1080p monitor look better.
I'm trying to think sorry, he never mentions the resolution, right? I'm wondering if maybe he has like a 720p 32-inch display.
Entirely possible. Which would still, you know, moving it farther away would still solve his problem. Not really. I mean,
moving it further away would definitely help it, but it would make
moving it closer would make it worse. Yeah, moving it farther away. And this is the problem with, because there's this kind of sweet spot where you're like, oh, a 30-inch flat panel is you know, for my PC is going to be $700. Oh, HP's got a new one for $680 out the door, and it's, you know, it's 2560 by 1600. I got to get that. And then you're like, oh, I can buy a 32-inch HDTV for $300. And the problem is 1080p is a big deal on an HDTV because TV used to be one quarter the resolution. And it also used to be 11 feet from your face. The Kell factor basically says as you increase the resolution, it looks good closer up to you, and you can sit closer to the device without kind of straining your eyes or being frustrated by the space between the pixels. A 32-inch 1080p HDTV is going to look great at 6 feet, and it's going to look awful at 3 feet if you're doing text, if you're doing, you know, and some people are going to argue with me, and by all means, if it's acceptable to you, that's great. But you're not going to get the kind of high resolution performance you want with a 1080p monitor, a 32 inch, or worse yet, a 44 or, you know, 46, 50 inch monitor, you know, on the other side, 3 feet away in your desk. You basically need to back up from your desk or back the monitor away from your face. And that's just the cold, hard reality of, you know, the kind of resolution we can deal with our eyes, resolve with our eyes. And the kind of resolution you don't have on a 32-inch display when it's very, very close to you. 1080p is awesome at 8 feet. You know, it's acceptable at 6 feet. Not so good 3 feet from your face or 2 feet from your face.
So we got an email here from Joey. Says, I currently have a GeForce 7900 GS. Yes, I know that's really old. Graphics card in my Core 2 Duo system. I haven't updated it in several years because I haven't played a hardcore game since Quake 3. I'm looking for something that's more power efficient than my current card without giving up performance. The 7750 seems to be such a card. But because it's such a large gap in generations, nobody online has comparisons between the two. What are your thoughts? Is this the best watt per usage card out there? Will the GeForce release similar cards anytime soon? Should I just keep going on my current card until it blows up? I wouldn't recommend until it blows up, because then it might take something with it. yes, you are correct, though. I can't remember the last time I've seen benchmarks of a 7900 GS, so I won't be able to tell you for sure what is maybe performance equivalent to that card in a modern generation. I would say a 7700 card is going to be at that level or maybe even a little bit higher, and it will definitely be more power efficient. In terms of performance per watt, definitely without a case. Mm-hmm. Core 2 Duo system, PCI Express still good. Yeah, power supply won't be an issue. There's definitely adapters for all that. NVIDIA will release a similar card in terms of performance per watt and pricing and that kind of stuff compared to the 7750 eventually, but I honestly don't know when. And you know, you're talking about when we get into cards at that performance level and that price level, the differences between them are going to be less dramatic. So I wouldn't feel bad telling you, yeah, go ahead out and buy a 7750 or 7770 today, knowing that or thinking that you're somehow going to get really ticked off when NVIDIA's 660 or 650 Ti or whatever it is comes out and is $20 cheaper necessarily. So I think you'd be good with that. I don't know how much more power efficient it's going to be. I don't know if it's going to save on noise or temperatures dramatically. So it's also possible that you may just want to use that card until it blows up and or you have enough money to maybe upgrade a larger portion of your machine. So, but I think the 7750 will do what you are looking for based on the parameters here. So,
should we do one last one before we go, or should we save it for next week? Okay. Yeah. Juan emails about the Raspberry Pi, says, I love the show. I have a question about mobile displays for the upcoming Raspberry Pi. I pre-ordered the Raspberry Pi, and I'm patiently waiting to set up the CPU in my house, says Juan. I have my keyboard, mouse, and display ready for the Pi, but I'm curious to see how it performs as a mobile device. I'm interested in buying a foldable keyboard so I can easily set up a mobile device riding the train or bus, but the missing device is the mobile display. Can you recommend a good, cheap mobile display in the market which
only works as a display. Basically, I want to set up a cheap alternative to a laptop, smartphone, or tablet. Am I making this idea more complicated because tablets and smartphones can possibly do the same thing, if not even faster? I would like to have a mobile device to program, check email and Wi-Fi hotspots, and be able to hook up to a TV screen to play videos and podcasts like Twitch. I love the concept. You know, this is one of those moments where I'm like, if you want something that works, you know, buy somebody's used smartphone or buy a new smartphone or if you want a really, you know, interesting project to hack your way through, you know, doing a Linux ARM version of the Raspberry Pi and fighting through the problems with mobile displays. Because it's really funny. If you look at the iPad 3 review, one of the really interesting things to look at is the number one thing that really impacts battery life. And they spent a lot of time working on battery life for the iPad 3, is reducing the screen brightness. And so not only you're going to have to figure out you're not only going to have to wire up a power supply to power the Raspberry Pi, you're also going to have to figure out a power supply to power the portable monitor. Are there options out there? Absolutely. But you're going to spend a lot of time building sort of a case to hold this or duct taping it together, figuring out how you're going to carry a battery, preferably not one that weighs like 6 pounds. In terms of recommending a good cheap mobile display, essentially you need, I want to say, you know, an HDMI or VGA compatible monitor. And at that point, you know, at this point, I'm thinking like, gosh, there's 12-volt monitors that are designed for in-car use that'll accept the output from the Raspberry Pi. But really, the one thing you're going to hammer up against this, because this is a fun project, is you know, the limitations of the operating system as it's been implemented for the Raspberry Pi hardware. You know, one, getting it in your hands, making sure it runs, getting it to run at home, and then finding an inexpensive monitor. You know, eBay would be a way to go. Local computer shops or maybe mobile installation shops do car stereos and stuff. Because you need your biggest problem isn't really, to me, going to be the display, because you can just find like a little VGA display, which is going to look awful because of the whole resolution issues we were just talking about. But finding a display with a decent resolution and figuring out how to power it is going to be a tremendous learning experience.
That's a great way of putting it. A learning experience. Not a huge pain in the butt or headache, but learning experience. That's how we got to look things optimistically. Yes. I agree. I would just say, hey, you know, they have $99 tablets now. You know, that's just my mentality.
If you want to do this for the fun and joy of hacking this together, yes. By all means, Juan, do it. If you're looking for a cheaper way, if you're looking for something cheaper but as useful as a smartphone or a tablet, I suggest you look for a cheaper tablet. You know, because this is going to be a fun, but you're going to spend a lot of time figuring this out, especially if you want something that's not going to take like both arms to carry on the train. Plus, you'll get a lot of stares when you have a bunch of batteries strapped to a monitor as you're wandering around looking nefarious.
Maybe people would have questions about that, wouldn't they?
I'm thinking of a certain incident I had pre 9/11 involving a beta notebook from a major vendor. Basically, it was one of the pre-release versions with the super rough tooling on the case, and it's as close as I've come to being strip searched and arrested trying to get through an airport. Like, it's a real notebook. Looks like you made this in the backyard. Well, a major employer in this city did.
Nice.
Yeah, it was a long day. What's coming up on PC Bird this week?
So this week we have to finish up all the stuff that I started last week before I went out of town, and that would include our 680 GTX 680 SLI testing, our GTX 680 surround testing, and maybe definitely SLI surround testing as well. Finally, compare the NVIDIA single GPU surround testing versus the AMD single GPU surround testing completely. Get it all out there and see what the performance is, and then do some SLI testing and see how well these things scale if you're able to find not just one, but two of them on a local store shelf.
Nice. So Techzilla, I'm in newborn mode, so I'm going to be out of the office through Monday next week. So I'm going to miss Techzilla. Thankfully, Robert stepped in. Robert and Veronica and Roger and Serafina are stepping up to cover for my absence. Wednesday next week, though, we should have a review of the IOSafe Solo G3. The quote, fireproof, waterproof external drive enclosure. It's really cool looking. If you haven't seen one, we got eyes and a little bit of hands on time. Yeah. Well, you know, if you're going to be fireproof, you may as well be heavy. That way they can find it. The way it falls through the True. Floor. And if the parts arrive, I'm going to be doing some stuff. Well, eventually I'll be doing some stuff. Whenever the parts arrive, they kind of been shipping ground by way of Siberia. Basically, I'm hiding my home theater gear using an IR repeater. So I've got a screen at one end of the room, and all of the home theater gear is hidden in a closet at the other end of the room. And I'm doing an infrared repeater that allows me to remotely control all my stuff. Yeah, I'm actually really excited about getting all that stuff hidden in the coldest room in the house. So it'll be running nice and cool. So nice. I got to say, that's going to be it. For everybody watching live, we apologize for the late start today. Leo was getting his podcast on. We want to thank everybody who stuck around for us. And we will see you. Well, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Schrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.